Start the third lecture. So yesterday I was trying to, you know, put us in Einstein's shoes and, you know, try to figure out how to include gravity into our description of physics. And so he was really looking for a field theory for gravity, which would be consistent with special relativity. Newton's theory certainly is not. And so he was very much inspired by Maxwell's theory, because it seemed like if you take a static limit, electrostatic limit of Maxwell's theory, you recover some kind of equations which are precisely those of Newton's equations. Apart from that, now you don't have charge densities, but you have mass densities and stuff like that. So that was one motivation and, you know, one ingredient he had, and he was formulating the theory. But then he soon realized that actually, you know, you cannot just formulate another field theory in flat space. And it's because gravity is very special. It's actually very, very different from electromagnetism in that gravity actually sort of tells you what an inertial frame is. So somehow the gravitational acceleration is related to the inertial acceleration. And so this is particularly nice captured by this equivalence principle. So you have several formulations of the equivalence principle, and we will see even more of the formulations later on in the course. But the simplest formulation is that because the inertial mass is the same as the gravitational mass, well, of course, the inertial acceleration equals to the gravitational acceleration here. So that's the simplest formulation of the equivalence principle. And as I said, you know, people still test this thing here. And there is no really a theory which would explain that the inertial mass is to be the gravitational mass. So in Einstein's general relativity, this is simply an assumption, and, you know, we go from there. Perhaps nicer, ingenious formulation of this principle is that of the Einstein's elevator, where really I'm saying that I can mimic the gravitational field G by simply accelerating upwards. And so the statement is that if you are a guy who is actually closed in the elevator and doesn't see outside, so the observer cannot really distinguish whether he is in a uniform gravitational field G or whether he is accelerating upwards. So that's why this picture is fundamentally wrong. This guy is actually not happy. This guy is happy. So that wouldn't happen because they cannot really tell what the difference is. So they all, both of them, have to look the same. Okay, so they don't. If they don't have any information for what's happening outside of the elevator, so now the picture is correct. So now, immediate consequences of this very simple principle, as we have seen yesterday, is, for example, the gravitational redshift. So if you send a signal, you know, from one point in space-time to another point in space-time, then if basically the signal has to climb up the gravitational field, of course, the frequency there, so it loses the energy, and so the frequency there, up there, will be smaller than the frequency closer to the strong gravitational field. And this was measured by Pound and Repka in 1960 and provides one of the fundamental tests of general relativity. There is another immediate consequence of this elevator, as we have seen yesterday, is the prediction that the light will bend in a gravitational field. So this is what we have predicted. And indeed, light bending was measured by Eddington in 1919, I hope. And so basically, until then, nobody really cared about Einstein. But once Eddington actually measured the light bending, which was a pure, you know, which was a genuine prediction of Einstein's theory of relativity, then Einstein became a celebrity overnight. And then he became like a prototype of a crazy scientist and prototype of a genius. Okay, so that's another thing which you can immediately say from the equivalence principle and from the Einstein's elevator idea. So now let me modify this principle here slightly, but you'll see it's exactly the same thing. Of course, if I can mimic the gravitational field by simply accelerating, I can also get rid of the gravitational field by accelerating. Okay, and so that's the idea. It's precisely this idea, but now just put it the other way, is the idea of local inertial frame. And So basically, if you are in free space when there is no gravity, no nothing, this must be equivalent to that if I am in gravitational field, there is a gravitational field G, I'm again in the elevator. But now I can simply get rid of the gravity by accelerating downwards. Okay, so then these observers will exactly feel the same thing. They will feel nothing. So here there is no gravitational field, no acceleration. I'm just, you know, freely floating in the space. Here I do have gravitational field, but I can cancel that gravitational field by going to a freely falling frame. And then I don't feel anything. Okay, so this is also sometimes, so it's called local inertia frame or freely falling frame. Or freely falling frame. And so this is a very, very useful and powerful idea. And again, you know, it's precisely this idea of Einstein elevator, just put it the other way around, right? And so what is beautiful about this is that, of course, you know that here in this frame, the special relativity has to be valid because you have no gravitational field whatsoever. And so, you know, basically, you know all the physics and it's described by special relativity. So must be for the observer here who is falling with the elevator down in the gravitational field. So here, special relativity is valid. And so basically now you have a prescription how to do physics in gravitational fields. Well, what you have to do is that you go first to a freely falling frame where you know exactly the laws of physics. They are described by special relativity, by electromagnetism, by Maxwell theory as you know it, or whatever. Okay, you solve the problem there. And then all you have to do is to transform to a coordinate system which you like. So for example, if you want to describe what's measured in the lab on the surface of the Earth, then you just, you know, make a coordinate transformation from this freely falling frame to the frame associated with the lab. Okay, so that's the idea. So we can solve physics in freely falling frame. And then basically make a coordinate transformation, and then make a coordinate transformation to any other frame and then we know how the physics look like in that new frame, for example, the frame associated with the lab on Earth. Okay, and so this powerful idea will be what you will be doing in your homework. So basically, you will be solving for an electric field produced by a charge who is sitting on the surface of the Earth in a gravitational field. And the way how to solve it is that you say, well, I first go to a freely falling frame, then I know the physics, it's just Maxwell theory. But if I go to a freely falling frame, I actually see the charge accelerating upwards because I'm freely falling down here. So effectively for me, the charge is going upwards. So now I have to solve for the field of this charge going upwards. Well, you know how to do it. It's the linear Wickert potential, which we discussed in the front end. So you can just write down the solution for the Maxwell field. And then all you have to do is that you take that solution and transform it to the frame, which is static with respect to the Earth. And then you have the solution. So that's what you will do for your homework. So now here, let me use this as a consequence of the Einstein elevator number 3. Consequence 3 is the Cherezik equation. So let us just ask. Okay, so we know that if you shoot a light and there is like free space, nothing, the light has, or whatever, it has a straight line. We also know that it bends in a gravitational field. But if we are in the freely falling frame, we see it as a straight line again. Okay? So in other words, what we want to do is that we want to now describe, so this guy sees a straight line, but let's find the shape in this gravitational field. Okay, so we want to describe the motion. So, you know, we want to describe a trajectory for light or trajectory for massive particle. So how we do it is that we say, well, let psi mu be coordinates in local inertial frame. So these are precisely the coordinates of that freely falling observer. And so in this case, we know that you know, the particles or the light moves in a straight line. So of course, there's the geodesic equation as we know it from special relativity. And so it's d squared psi mu d tau square equals to zero. So that's our special relativity geodesic equation, which is nothing else than a straight line. Okay, so now this is how, so we have straight lines in our local inertial frame. But now let's look at how this looks like in some other frame. So in some other frame, described by some coordinates x alpha, which are now functions of my coordinates, of my local coordinates psi. So for example, now we want to really describe how this looks like from a point of view of an observer who is standing on the Earth. So he better see this shape of the trajectory. So we want to describe this trajectory, or better, we want to find an equation for this trajectory. So in some other frame, x alpha as a function of psi, well, we want to find this equation. Okay, so then we have, well, of course, we assume that the transformation between the frames is invertible, so I can equally write psi mu as psi mu of x. So that's what you assume. So let's just find what it is. So we know that, so we have d over d tau, so 0 equals to this thing here, is d over d tau, d psi mu over d tau. But psi mu is a function of x. So now I use the chain rule. So I want to write d psi mu over d tau. So I write d psi mu over d x alpha, d x alpha over d tau. So this is d psi mu over d tau. And I have to do one more d over d tau. So I will have two terms here, because I have, okay. So then, again, I write d over d tau as d over dx beta, dx beta over d tau. So if I differentiate the first one here, I will have d square psi mu over dx beta dx alpha dx beta d tau dx alpha tau. And then if I differentiate the second one, I will have d psi mu over dx alpha, and then d square x alpha d tau square. Everybody happy so far? So this is almost the equation which we are looking for. So we better write this equation as d square of x alpha d tau square equals to something. So we have to get rid of what stands in front of that. So we have to get rid of this thing here. So now use a simple trick. Use a simple trick that if you differentiate two coordinates, you just get delta whatever thing. So if I do dx nu over dx alpha, what is this equal to? Delta nu alpha, thank you. Delta nu alpha. But of course, I can also write it in terms of the size. So I can write it as dx nu over d psi mu d psi mu over dx alpha. I hope nobody objects to this. So this is certainly true. So now you see what we have to do. So we have this term here, which is problematic term which we want to kill, so that we have just d square x alpha over d tau square equals to something. So now we know how to kill it. We just have to multiply the equation by dx nu over d xi mu, and that will just give us delta nu alpha. And so then we just change the index here to nu. All right. So, but we take this equation here, and so multiply our equation here by dx nu over the xi mu. Okay, and use this trick here. So if we multiply dx nu by dx nu dxi mu, this will just pick up delta nu alpha. So I just change this index to nu. And then we have an equation, 0 equals to d square x nu d tau square. And then I have to write whatever I did. So plus dx nu dxi mu d square psi mu dx alpha dx beta dx alpha dx beta. Everybody happy so far? Super simple, isn't it? Okay, so now if you look at this equation, at this point it's super ugly. We have some monster standing here. Okay. Okay, so you know, this thing here is simple. It's just the four velocity, right? So dx alpha over d tau is just what we called four velocity before. So it's just u alpha. So this term is nice. It's u alpha. This term is nice. It's u beta. This is just the derivative of u nu with respect to tau. So that's also nice. So the only monster is here. And so the way how you get rid of the monster is that you just call it, introduce a symbol, and call it something else. So now you see I'm summing over index mu. Okay, so there won't be any index mu in that monster. But there's a free index nu, free index alpha, and free index beta. So let's call this thing a gamma nu alpha beta. And so we dealt with the monster. And we have a beautiful equation now. Okay, so the beautiful equation is that d u nu over d tau plus gamma nu alpha beta u alpha u beta equals to 0. And that's now our beautiful equation for the motion, which describes the trajectory in any frame. In particular, it better describe that our light is actually bending on the surface of the Earth. So it will describe this type of trajectory. This equation is called geodesic equation. Okay. So now we have the monster. We haven't dealt with it completely. We just, we just put a symbol to it. But we also put a name, and so the name is a Christoffel symbol. Okay, so this guy is called Christoffel symbol. And so now we are all done with the geodesic equation.
The physical frame x alpha is not an inertial frame. It can be any.
No. So the xi mu is the inertial frame, is the one which is freely falling. X alpha is any other frame. So
if it is a normal frame, then we just use Lorentz.
Oh, very good. Thank you so much. So this thing here, I can do any transformation now on my. So I start with an inertial frame described by coordinates xi. But then I can go to any other frame. I can go to a rotating frame. I can go to an accelerated frame. I am departing from special relativity now. So now actually I am, you know, I'm allowing a general coordinate transformation here, which is not bound by anything. But now if you look at, so let's say if I did only a Lorentz transformation. So then Lorentz transformation is such that x prime is just lambda times x. So it's constant times x. So if you did a Lorentz transformation, then if you had xi, well, if you had x is lambda, well, xi is lambda times x, basically. So Lorentz transformation would be that xi is something like lambda times x. So that would be Lorentz transformation. Well, lambda is a constant. So now if I differentiate xi twice with respect to x, I kill this term. So the Lorentz transformation will not have any gammas associated to that. Okay. So in other words, and it's precisely what we know, is that if you do Lorentz transformations, the equations have to preserve the form. The form of our equation, of the geodesic equation, is this one. So if you do Lorentz transformation, the form of the geodesic equation better be just du nu over d tau equals to zero. It has to preserve the form if I do a Lorentz transformation. However, I am not restricting to Lorentz transformations, so I don't just require that. I can consider any coordinate transformation whatsoever. And if you do that, you pick up this term here. Any other question? All right, so we have geodesic equation. So we introduced a new symbol. Let us deal with this symbol a little bit more. So at this point, it's just this horrible thing here. But we can actually write it nicely in terms of the curved metric. So let us now introduce the curved metric. And the way we do it is that we just doing a coordinate transformation on our nice Linkowski metric. So we know that the metric or the element just looks like ds square is minus d tau square. And so if we are in locally inertial frame, then it has to look like a Minkowski metric, dxi mu, dxi nu. So this is the fact that we are in locally inertial frame. Okay, so then, you know, this must be true. So if I am freely falling, my metric is just Minkowski metric. But now we have done the coordinate transformation, and so we understand xi as a function of x. So now we can do that dxi is actually dxi over dx, dx. Okay, so this is equal to eta mu nu dxi mu dx alpha dxi nu dx beta dx alpha dx beta. Okay, so just using the fact that we have now new coordinates, I mean just transforming according to the coordinates. Okay, so very good. So dx alpha, dx beta looks promising. And so we sum over mu and nu. So this object has only index alpha and beta. Let's just call it a curved metric g alpha beta. And so we have a new definition for the curved metric, which is this one here, that eta mu nu dxi mu dx alpha dxi nu over dx beta. Okay, and our metric element, now our interval simply writes in terms of the curve metric as ds square is g alpha beta dx alpha dx beta. That's how our metric element now looks like in terms of the curve metric. So now, yes?
We can do this. We can pass from an inertial frame of reference to a non-inertial frame of reference because of the Coulomb's principle, or what? Why we can do this?
I'm saying all we know is that if you are in the freely falling system here, our special relativity laws are valid. Okay, so we better. So what we want to do is that we want to describe how things, you know, change under the influence of gravity. So how the physical laws change so I know the physical laws without gravity. So now I want to generalize them to what happens if I have gravitational field. And so this is the prescription. So what you do is that you first go to a freely flowing frame, and then you know that the laws, as you know them, are valid. So then you are asking, well, what happens if I now actually am in this gravitational field, if I transform, let's say, to a frame where I actually see that there is a gravitational field downwards. So for example, to the frame which is static on the Earth. Okay, and this will just be given by some coordinate transformation. And the statement is, yeah, if I actually do this coordinate transformation, my geodesic equation picks up this extra term, which is due to the gravitational field. Similarly, my metric is no longer Minkowski metric, but it will be something more complicated, which in principle, you know, because psi mu and x alpha are complicated functions, so this metric will no longer be minus 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1, but it will be some general, you know, functions of the coordinates. Does it make sense? So really what you are aiming is to find the laws, how they look like in the gravitational field. How the standard laws as we know them modify due to the gravitational field. Okay, so now notice, of course, from this definition here, it's obvious because dx alpha and dx beta are symmetric in alpha and beta. Well, the metric g alpha beta is symmetric in alpha and beta. So we know that g alpha beta is, I have been using this thing. So if I use these brackets here, it's like a symmetrization. So it doesn't matter if I symmetrize or not, the metric is symmetric. Sometimes I also put like this thing here if the indices are symmetric. But anyway, so what it means really is that g beta alpha is the same as g alpha beta. I can swap the indices and it doesn't matter. So now, generally, so we have, of course, our original metric, Minkowski metric, let's say it's four-dimensional. So then our curve metric is four-dimensional. So how many components this asymmetric matrix in four dimensions has?
Ten,
exactly. So in general, this will have, in general, the curve metric has 10 components. 10 components, and they in general depend on the coordinates. So you see that actually gravity is quite nasty because it's just changed the, you know, Minkowski metric, which is super nice, minus 1, plus 1, plus 1, plus 1, to something which in general will have 10 components. It's still symmetric, but it will have 10 components. But these components can be quite nasty. They can depend on, you know, I don't know, sine theta or whatever. They depend on the coordinates in general. All right, but there are some nice things as well. So notice that I was writing this minus d tau square here. And so then we have an equation that ds square is still minus d tau square. So what I can do is that I can divide by d tau. And of course, this will just become dx alpha over d tau, which is the velocity, and dx beta over d tau, which is the four velocity. So then you are writing that actually you're still finding that u square, which is u alpha u beta g alpha beta, is still equal to what? Minus 1. So for example, the four velocity is still nicely normalized, although now you calculate the scalar product, if you want, in terms of this curved metric. Not in terms of the flat metric, but in terms of the curved metric. All right. So now, once we have the metric, we can also introduce the inverse metric in the same way as we did it for the Minkowski metric. So the inverse metric better satisfies, well, gg minus 1 is equal to 1. But it's customary to write g minus 1 as simply g with indices upstairs. So you have inverse metric g alpha beta. And it's simply characterized by the fact that if you take g alpha beta, g beta gamma, it just gives you delta alpha gamma. So this is how you introduce the inverse metric. So if I, and of course, you know, given this, I can find that uniquely because there's only one inverse. So now we have inverse metric. Okay. So now why is this metric useful? Is that now we can actually simplify, well, not really, but you can write down some nice expression for these Christoffel symbols just in terms of the metric. Okay, and so the statement is, so now you can sort of see it, right? So if you have the metric, which is given basically by the first derivative of psi with respect to x, that's our definition of the metric. It's just a first derivative of psi with respect to x. But now if you look at our monster there, gamma, it has actually the term which is a second derivative of psi with respect to x. Okay? So we can sort of guess is that gamma should behave like a derivative of the metric. Okay, this should be obvious from that relation there. So now the precise statement is this one. So statement. Is that you can write down gamma nu alpha beta as 1/2 g nu mu, which is our inverse metric. And then you take the metric and you do a partial derivative of that metric. So it will be mu alpha beta plus g mu beta alpha minus g alpha beta mu. Okay, so that's the prescription how you can find the Christoffel symbol in terms of the curved metric. And so it seems as a formidable formula, but it's not really. So first notice, so why I am putting this inverse metric here? Well, because I have an index upset here. So if you just write, so sometimes people call this the Christoffel symbol of the second kind. So this will be the second kind Christoffel symbol. Well, it's only one kind, but anyway. So the difference is that you either raise the index or not. Okay, so I can write this rise index g nu alpha beta as g nu mu of a Christoffel symbol which has all indices down. Okay, so I'm just raising this index here. And so this Christoffel symbol then is sometimes called first kind. So first kind Christoffel symbol is completely useless. So don't get, you know, too excited about having second and first kind Christoffel symbols. But this guy here is simply origin of this metric here. So now if you look at the first kind Christoffel symbol, it doesn't have this thing here, and it's just given by these derivatives of g. Okay, so just a warning. But anyway, so now there's a big confusion about this thing here. Once you start putting the index down, so let's not, okay. Once you start putting the index down, some people take this index and put it down here, which is a natural thing. But some people also put it here. Okay, so that's a source of confusion. So let's not use these at all. Okay. Okay, so we have simply Christoffel symbols. We don't need to distinguish first kind or second kind. They are always with index one, which one index which is up, and then the formula is given here.
In special relativity, we could relate the metric with the Lorentz transformations, and then we have a group, Lorentz group. But in this case, can we have?
We have completely general coordinate transformations.
So it is not a group. Or you cannot relate it with a group.
You mean like, no. Yeah, okay. So if you discuss general relativity in terms of the field binds, in terms of the orthonormal basis, then the freedom is general linear transformations. So you can do any transformations of these field binds on these orthonormal vectors. At this level, when we discuss the coordinates and stuff like that, it's just I can do any coordinate transformations. All right, so now this is the statement. Of course, you can try to prove the statement from the definitions I gave you. So the proof of the statement, well, it's obvious that it has to be a derivative of g. But the actual proof is super plain. is fame. So, well, of course, what you have to do is that you have to calculate what the right-hand side is. And then you have to show that the right-hand side equals to the definition of our monster gamma as we define it over there. Okay? So, for example, you have to calculate this gamma mu alpha beta, g mu alpha beta. Okay, so what is this? So it's d over dx beta, d over dx beta. And then our metric g mu alpha is defined over here. So, okay, so then we have g mu alpha. So that will be d xi, and that will be dx mu and dx alpha. And then I will have some index, which I sum over with. So it's, let's say, kappa, and delta. So this is our metric g mu alpha as we defined it here. And we just have to take a derivative here. So now it's obvious, well, this is a constant. So I will have two terms to differentiate. I will differentiate this one here, and then I will differentiate that one there. Okay, so I will have two terms, each of which has two derivatives of xi with respect to x. Okay, which look like the gamma terms over there. Okay, so what you can show, and you know, you have to use this, the trick which we used already, that dx nu over dx alpha is delta nu alpha. So there is maybe three more lines missing here. But what you should find is that this is given by g kappa alpha gamma kappa beta mu plus g mu kappa gamma kappa alpha beta. Okay, so just, you know, do the differentiation. Use that trick if you want, and use the definition of the Christoffel symbol there, and then this is what you should find. So now this is, however, just one term in this bloody formula here. So now you have to calculate the second term, g mu beta alpha, and then you have to calculate the third term, g alpha beta mu. So now, so plus two other terms, And then you put them all together, and you better find that this is equal to g nu alpha beta. And so that gives you the proof. Okay? So I'm not attempting to do it here. That will take the rest of the lecture, and it's not really eliminating. It's just using the definition of our gamma, using the definition of the g, and that small trick there. Okay? So this is how you prove the formula. So now how you remember that formula, which is very useful formula. Well, okay, so the first inverse metric there is just to write the index, okay? So then I'm dealing with the index mu. And then what you need to do is that, obviously, you know, the two indices alpha and beta here, if you look at how they enter the geodesic equation, they are multiplied by u alpha and u beta. So that's an expression, u alpha, u beta, is symmetric in alpha and beta. So that's why the Christoffel symbol is actually symmetric in alpha and beta. If it were antisymmetric, it wouldn't do anything. So the Christoffel symbol has to be symmetric in alpha and beta. So let's see what we do. So we take, always in the first two terms, we take a derivative with respect to alpha or beta. But we have to have something symmetric. So that's why we symmetrize over that. We sum over this. So if you have term alpha slash beta, you have to have plus beta slash alpha, because otherwise it's not symmetric. And finally, we have the last term, where the two alpha and beta stand by the metric, not the derivative. But of course, the metric is symmetric in alpha and beta. So that doesn't break the symmetry. So this is how you remember the formula. You cannot be wrong. You just, you know, differentiate with respect to one index down, and differentiate with respect to the other index down. But they have to be summed together because of the symmetry. And then I have minus g alpha beta. So that's how you remember this.
And the minus signs from where?
Just have to remember. So, you know, you typically can recover most of the formulas in general relativity by just looking at the symmetries of the objects up to a sign or up to some factors, right? So I cannot deal with this. If there were two, I couldn't recover it from. Yeah. So up to a sign, you typically, or up to some factors of two, you're typically right. Okay, and so that's it. So we have now a geodesic equation, just starting from the equivalence principle or from the Einstein's elevator. Okay, so this is how you write down the geodesic equation. So now let's assume that we have this geodesic equation, and what it really does is describes how the particles or light moves in a gravitational field. Okay, so now what is the Newtonian counterpart to this equation?
To which equation?
To the geodesic equation, which describes the trajectories of the particles in a given gravitational field. So the Newtonian counterpart will be just dp over dt equals to minus gradient of phi, where phi is the Newtonian potential. Okay, so now, of course, this equation better reduces to our Newton's equation in the right limit when the gravitational field is weak, when it is static, and when the velocities are not too high. Okay, so let's take a non-relativistic limit of this equation, or Newtonian limit of this equation.
Why can't we do a similar thing here? There is one that we start from an inertial frame, so we are just following first law, and then we just do coordinate transformation similarly. So, like, how would that defy Newton's law? I don't, like, we can do coordinate transformations irrespective of, like, what theory we are taking into account, whether we are taking relativity into account or not. So we can start from an inertial frame, do the same thing over, and we should get the same results back. Why do we need the presence of a potential to do that?
No. Okay, so this is our equation. What happens with particles in the gravitational field, right? So we want to really describe the effect of gravitational field on the motion of the particles, let's say. Okay, so then this is described by the Newton's equation, dp over dt is minus grad phi. So we, you know, this better reduces to that. Of course, if I am not in the inertial frame, in the Newtonian case, I will pick up some crap on the right-hand side as well, like Coriolis forces and other forces, the inertial forces, right? So these are precisely captured by these gammas there. Okay, so now I want to, you know, sort of go to almost an inertial frame and then see, you know, how does this equation compare to just minus gradient of phi equation. That's what we are now trying to do. Okay, so now, but what is this? C maybe? Newtonian limit. All right, so we want to look at the Newtonian limit of geodesic equation. And so there will be several assumptions which I, you know, which we have to impose. So first of all, we know that Newtonian physics is actually non-relativistic. So a non-relativistic description is works quite well if you don't have large velocities. If you have slowly moving objects, then Newtonian physics will be fine. So the first approximation which we have to do is the slow motion approximation. So now our coordinates x mu, so we have the coordinates x mu, which are t and xi. Okay, and of course the slow motion means that the velocity is dominated, the four velocity is dominated just motion in time, by motion in time, rather than motion in space. So we rather move in time, we don't move much in space. So what we require is that the xi over d tau, which is the four velocity, the spatial part of the four velocity, is much smaller than dt over d tau. So that's the requirement of slow motion. So in other words, the velocity, the spatial velocity, is much smaller than the speed of light. It's the same thing as vi, well, v is much smaller than c. C, okay? So now, okay, very good. So if you look at your geodesic equation, okay, so we, okay, I wrote it in a stupid way. So we have du nu over d tau is gamma nu alpha beta u alpha u beta, but now I have to plug back what u is, so it's dx alpha over d tau. Okay, so now I'm saying that the four velocity, the dominating part of the four velocity is just the dt over d tau part. Okay, in which case the index alpha has to be just t, and the index beta has to be just t, because that's the dominating part. Okay, so now our equation just becomes d square x nu over d tau square plus gamma nu, and then the dominating part is dt over d tau, dt over d tau equals to zero. I'm throwing away all the other terms, which are basically, so this is like a zero order expansion in velocity, in the spatial velocity, right? So I would have, the next order term would be where I would have dxi over d tau, which would be linear term in velocity, and then I would have dt over d tau. And the next term would be dxi over d tau, dxj over d tau, which would be quadratic in velocity. So I'm just keeping the zero order term in velocity here.
It couldn't be possible that the gamma terms would make up for
it? It could. Oh, that's right. But certainly, you know, this thing will only be valid. I only recover the Newton's theory if I have slow motion. So what I have to do nevertheless is, of course, this can be quite large, whatever. This can, you know, be whatever it needs to be. But I am doing an expansion in small velocities. That's the, you know, simplest assumption you can do. You know that Newtonian physics is only valid if you have slow velocities. So I'm doing expansion in velocity. Does it answer your question?
Maybe. No, I was just thinking, like,
no, no.
You, what you're saying, I'm just saying that maybe the Christoffel symbols could make up for it in the other terms.
It's true. But then I wouldn't be really describing, you will see later, then I will not be describing really Newtonian physics, but you will be describing something like Maxwell theory. If you keep terms which are linear in velocities, you describe basically the Lorentz force law. Okay? So we're just keeping the first term. So zeros order in the velocity v. Okay? So slow motion is the first assumption. Second assumption is that we know that the field is static in Newton's theory. Static field. So in other words, what it means is that if I take my metric and I take a partial derivative with respect to the time coordinate, it has to be zero, right? Because my gravitational field cannot be time varying. It's not time varying in Newton's theory. It's just instantaneous action. So it is there once and forever. Okay, so g mu nu over t, partial derivative t, is equal to zero. So now this is a tremendous simplification for the Christoffel symbols. So now what we need to calculate is this gamma nu tt Christoffel symbol to see what this geodesic equation gives us. So now we have to calculate gamma nu tt. Okay, let's look at our complicated formula here. So it's 1/2 g nu mu, 1/2 g nu mu, and then it's g plus g minus g. Okay, so that's the formula. So this minus g, I just take dt over mu, okay? And then I will have a term g mu T plus T mu G T. Using that formula there. All right, but my metric is static. So this term is gone, and that term is gone. So the only term which survives is the last term, which is the time component of the metric, GTT component of the metric. So now this is equal to minus 1/2 G mu mu G T T over mu. So that's how much our Christoffel symbol has simplified because the metric is static. Okay. The last assumption is that our gravitational field is not too strong. So we have weak field, weak field. So this is a little bit sneaky assumption. So basically what we are saying is that our metric can be written in such a frame that it almost looks like a Minkowski metric plus some small perturbation. Okay? So then we are saying that G mu nu is basically given by the Minkowski metric plus a small perturbation, H mu nu. And by, you know, what does it mean small? It means that I throw away the terms which are high order in H. Okay, so that's what a weak field approximation means. I just have flat metric plus a linear perturbation.
Do we have to impose something on the derivative of H? Say that there
We probably will not need that. Well, we will not need that for sure. But maybe you need to, well, okay, which derivatives? Special derivatives of H. Not for the geodesics. Probably need for something else. Yeah.
For linearized gravity, you
I think I am not sure. I will have to go through the calculation. Well, you will do it soon. So you will see. All right. So that's our weak field approximation. So now we have to use this weak field approximation to really see what this gamma is. Okay. So if we have the metric G mu nu with the index down, like that, eta plus h, then if you want to write down G mu nu with index upstairs, then surprise, surprise, this is given by the flat metric with the index upstairs, now minus h mu nu. Okay, so why is that? Well, symbolically, I can write eta plus h, and then I require that this is an inverse metric, so this better be equal to 1. So now, if you multiply this thing here, you have eta eta, which is 1, and then you have eta, so minus eta h, and then you have plus eta h, which cancel, and then you have h times h, which is h squared, which I throw away. So this works. Okay, so really, if you want to write down the metric with indices upstairs, all you have to do is that you just put a minus sign here, and that gives you the right thing to, for the All right, so now let's use this for our Christoffel symbol. So all we have to calculate is this object here. So we have the inverse metric, which is given here. And then we have GTT over mu. But what we are doing here when we are doing GTT over mu is that we are differentiating the curve metric. Okay. But if you look at the curve metric, it's this thing here. So if you differentiate eta mu nu, because it's constant, this doesn't have any contribution. Okay, so the only contribution comes from H mu nu. Okay, so this term will only behave like H tt over mu. But then if you look at the inverse metric here, well, the expression here is already linear in H. Okay, because this thing only contributes at the linear level of H. So if I take this to be just the flat metric, I cannot make any mistake, because otherwise I would have higher order terms in H. Okay, so now our Christoffel symbol, G nu tt, just become equal to minus 1/2, and then eta nu mu H tt over mu. Everybody happy with this? So that's the only way how we can do it, because this thing, I differentiate something, but if I differentiate eta, I get zero. So this does not contribute. So this term has to contribute. And so then I have already linear in H expression. So I can just write eta nu mu. Yes?
So here we use the fact that the derivative of H are small. Because we're getting rid of the.
Yeah. Well, OK, very good. So you're right. I'm keeping everything to the linear order in H and to the linear order in derivatives of H. And you're right. So yeah, you're right.
I'm sorry. We didn't cancel the derivative anywhere. How did the order of the derivative come into play here?
No. I'm saying that the only contribution to this guy is from H,
yeah.
Right? And so that's what I'm writing there.
Sorry. I don't get
that. And I assume that this is small, and then you're right, yeah.
I don't get why we have to change to it, yeah, instead of g.
Oh, so you can put g, but g is eta minus h. So then I will have h times h, which is I'm throwing away. Okay. So plus OH square terms. Okay. All right, so that's our Christoffel symbol.
What is the H mu nu with the upper stairs indices?
What is what?
H mu nu with upper stairs.
Oh, so it's just this H? Oh, very good. That's a good question. It's this H, but now I raise the index with the flat metric. So now, very good. So now our equation is super simple equation. It's just d square x nu d tau square, and then it's minus 1/2. Eta nu mu h dt mu dt over d tau dt over d tau equals to zero. So that's our equation, what it becomes under these three assumptions. Okay. So now what you have to do next is that you have to look at various components of this equation. So you have the index nu, which is free index, and I can take it to be t, or I can take it to be a spatial index. Okay. So let's take nu equal to t first. So then we have d square xt over d tau square.
Well, can you immediately replace the mu, restrict the mu to go only over the spatial indices, right?
That's true, yeah.
I agree.
Which I'm going just to now, yeah. Exactly. Yeah, that's right. So anyway, so if I plug nu equal to be t, so nu if it's equal to t, you're right, I could do that. So then mu has to be equal to t. But if mu is equal to t, I'm doing a time derivative of this guy, so I get a zero here. So it's plus zero equals to zero. Okay, I'm stupid. Of course, xt is just t, right? So I have d squared t d tau squared plus zero equals to zero. So in other words, dt over d tau, dt over d tau is equal to a constant. Let's call it c. And so this part of the equation is boring. It's just dt over d tau is a constant. So now let's look at the spatial part of the equation. So nu is equal to I. So then I have d square x I over d tau square, which I can write as d t square. dt square times dt over d tau square, which is c square from the first equation, minus 1/2. So now index nu is I, so index nu better be I as well. It's plus h dt I, and then there is eta, well, okay, j eta I j. And then dt over d tau is constant, so sweet c square. We're just plugging everything here. All right. So c square is not important. I can cancel that. And I have a beautiful equation. Is that d square xi over dt square equals to 1/2. And this thing is just delta ij, right? So the spatial part of the Minkowski metric, so this is just delta ij. So it's 1/2 htt over I. Let's hope the sign is correct. So the time component of the equation is trivial. The spatial component of the equation gives you this. So now we want to compare this with the Newton. So compare to Newton. And of course, Newton is telling you that d square xi over d tau square is minus nabla I phi Newton. That's what the Newton equation is. Okay, so does this agree? Can I make this agree? What do you think? So I want this thing equals to that thing. Well, you can make it agree, provided, of course, this is just htt. So that's what nabla I is, right? So this is 1/2 nabla I htt. So you see that htt has to be related to the Newtonian potential by equal to minus 2. So we conclude that phi Newton is actually described by this htt. So in other words, we know how first component of the metric has to look like if this is to be agreed with the Newton theory. We know that gtt, so g is eta plus h. We know what h is, htt is. Eta dt is minus 1. Okay, so gtt has to be equal to minus 1 plus, and then we have this 2 phi Newton. And then let me put the velocity of light, so that just we know what's going on here. There's 2 phi Newton, and this is the velocity of light, c square. So this is what we just derived. So if our geodesic equation is to agree with the Newton's law in the appropriate limit of static field, weak field, and slowly moving particles, our metric has to look like this. At least the TT component of the metric has to have a form. It's minus 1 plus phi Newtonian over the speed of light square.
I just missed before when you were saying before we were looking at the T component for our equation.
So this is an equation which is valid for any nu.
Yeah.
So I can plug for nu equal to T, mm-hmm. right? And then I can plug nu equal to I.
Yeah.
The spatial component. So what is your question?
The question is just, so we're dropping the time derivative of HTT, that's what it...
That's right. So we are dropping any time dependence whatsoever.
Okay.
Right? So time derivative will be zero.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. everything is static and nice. Okay, so we just derived this. So in other words, you know, in the weak field approximation, in the Newtonian limit approximation, our metric has to look like E squared must be minus 1 plus 2 phi Newton divided by C squared dt squared plus other components of the metric. Okay? So now I'll tell you what the other components of the metric are, although you cannot derive them by comparing with the geodesic equation. So from the geodesic equation, you just get the first term. If you solve the field equations and compare to Laplace equation, which we will do next week, then you get this result here. And then it's 1 minus d phi Newton divided by c square. And then you have just dx squared delta ij dxi dxj. So this is more generally how the metric looks like. So in the, you know, weak field approximation. So what was that question?
It's just we see that we could have taken phi and htt equals with a constant. I mean, if we added a constant, it wouldn't change the fact that we have the same equation.
Yeah, of course, the potential is only defined up to a constant.
Yeah. When we have the metric, sometimes we have the metric, not the derivative, but just the metric appearing.
So you know, okay, very good. Two answers to a question. One answer is that what you typically want is that this really reduces to the flat metric as you know it, if you are far away from the sources. So if I'm far away from the sun, I better be in flat space. And so, you know, you basically tune this potential or whatever so that this really approaches minus dt squared plus dx squared, whatever. So that's the first answer. Second answer is that you know that in Newtonian physics, really the value of the potential doesn't matter. What matters is the difference between the potentials at different places. Okay? So that's what really describes physics. So similarly, you know, if you start, you know, so the metric itself, as we will see later, doesn't really describe truly the gravity. What describes true gravity is the tidal forces. The tidal forces are described by the derivatives of the metric. So then if you start adding some constants or whatever, they will not really be important. They shouldn't be important. All right, so anyway, so this is the weak field limit. We couldn't derive this part. So only this thing comes from the geodesic equation. Geodesic equation. This I am giving you, but cannot be derived from there. So this is true, but I did not justify this yet. In fact, for most of the problems, this part really doesn't matter. All you need to know is this thing here. Okay? So we just learned that actually, if our theory of gravity, you know, has to reduce to Newton's theory, we have some, you know, fundamental restrictions on how the metric has to look like. So now the question is, you know, is this really satisfied? So for which objects I can use the weak field approximation, the Newtonian approximation? And so that will be true as long as my h is really a small perturbation. So I was treating in the derivation that h is a small perturbation to my flat metric eta. And so then I could derive this result. So then basically what you are requiring is that the phi Newton divided by c square is much, much smaller than 1. Okay, so we demand it. So basically, I can use this metric, can use this, you know, weak field theory metric or whatever, weak field metric, provided that phi n, phi Newton divided by c square is much, much smaller than 1. Then really my h mu nu is much, much smaller than 8 mu nu. I could throw away the higher order terms. And so this is the first, you know, thing which you should look at. So now, of course, what you can do is that you can evaluate the Newtonian potential and divide it by c square. Of course, c is quite big. C square is even bigger. So then you actually can look at, for example, the surface of the Earth. We have Earth here. Okay. And then you can ask, what is the value of the Newtonian potential on the surface of the Earth? And is this still valid? Can I use this kind of metric? Can I use weak field approximation? Is my Newtonian theory basically valid on the surface of the Earth? Well, it better be, because it has agreed with all the experiments until Einstein, right? So if you calculate this quantity phi n over c square, of course, what I'm taking for phi n is just gm over r. And gm over r, so this thing on the surface of the Earth, so phi n goes like gm over r of the Earth. Okay, and so if you calculate phi n over c square, what you find that this is, this ratio is actually 10 to minus 9. Of the order 10 to minus 9. So then, really, on the surface of the Earth, you don't have to really too much bother about general relativity. And you know, Newtonian theory basically gives you the right result. Of course, that is not true, because you know that you have your GPS system. And so now we live in high precision physics and high precision technology. And so you know that actually you have to correct for gravitational field in order your GPS to show your position correctly. And it's precisely correcting at the order 10 to minus 9. Okay, so that's what's happening with GPS. Note, however, GPS. Okay. But anyway, so this is teeny tiny. So then you may be asking, well, what about the sun? Okay, so sun is much bigger, much more massive. So if I am on the surface of the sun, what will be this thing here? What is phi n over c square? Well, then you find it's not 10 to minus 9, but it's 10 to minus 6. So still super, super small. So I don't really need to use general relativity for the sun unless I'm interested in, you know, the six-digit corrections to my physics. Of course, that can be measured, six-digit corrections. But I can mostly use, you know, Newtonian theory. However, there are beasts in the universe, like neutron stars. Where there are super dense stars formed by gravitational collapse. And so for them, if you calculate what is this ratio on the surface of that star, it's actually of the order 10 to minus 2 to 10 to minus 1. So now you have corrections of the order of 10%. And finally, you have black holes where this is 10 to minus 1. So for black holes, definitely you need to use general relativity. Okay? But you see that for everyday life, apart from GPS, it really doesn't matter. Okay. Questions? Yes?
We didn't figure out how we got the c squared term over there.
Oh, we didn't. So what I'm telling you is, so what we derive, it's that in our units where I'm setting c equal to 1, right? I'm mostly setting the speed of light equal to 1. We just derive that htt is minus 2 phi Newton. So now in order this to have the right units, I'm telling you, well, phi Newton is not really a dimensionless quantity. So if I want to form a dimensionless quantity, I have to divide by velocity square. And you know, so I recovered C back in there. Okay, very good. So now let me discuss so that you can do today's tutorial. Let me go back to the gravitational redshift, but now equipped with this new metric description and this new thing. So back to gravitational redshift. So what we notice is that if you have a gravitational field, then if you have an observer 1 here, and if you have an observer 2 here, then they actually need not to, their proper time, need not to go the same way. Or, you know, the frequency, if you send a signal from this guy to, and this guy observes it, you know, they can have different frequencies. Okay? So now let's say this observer. So I have, you know, fixed space-time, I have fixed metric, fixed curve metric, g mu nu. But this fixed curve metric may depend on the position in the space-time. So you may have g mu nu at the position x, which is the position of the observer 1. And then you have g mu nu at the position x prime, which is the position of the observer 2. Okay, so then you may be asking, well, how does the proper time of this observer goes with respect to the proper time of that observer. Okay. So then you want to compare, you know, this observer has d tau, and this observer has d tau prime. Okay. So now I'm interested in the ratio of, you know, is proper time of one observer going differently from the other one. So now you are interested in the ratio d tau over d tau prime. Okay, we still have the magic formula somewhere. So let's see, is it not this one? Maybe, no, we don't. So remember, we define our curve metric to be ds square equals to minus d tau square equals to g mu nu dx mu, dx nu. Okay, so this is how we basically define our curve metric. Okay, so in other words, d tau is just square root of the curve metric thing. So this is a square root of minus g mu nu dx mu, dx nu. Okay, but I can also write it in terms of the coordinate time. So I can write it in terms, so I have coordinates, which are t and xi. So I can divide everything by dt and multiply by dt. So that's what d tau is here. And then I can write the same thing for tau prime. This is evaluated at the point x. And then the same thing for tau prime is minus g mu nu dx mu dt, dx nu, dt, dt at the point x prime. And that's what it is, right? I'm just writing the d tau is the square root here. And so now I evaluate, if I want the proper time here, I just evaluate this at the point x. If I want the proper time here, I evaluate it at the point x prime. Happy? Reasonably happy. Okay. So now, of course, this dt is the same as that dt, right? Because I just have a global time everywhere. And this is just a coordinate time defined everywhere. So this cancels that. Okay. And so that's my general expression for the ratio of the proper times. But now let's specify to a simple case when the observers are actually static. So they are not moving with respect to my coordinates. So the only motion which they make is motion in time. They don't move in space. So static observers, they simply have just, so d x mu over d tau, they simply have 1 and 0 and 0. They only move in time, they don't move in space. Okay, and so then your formula reduces significantly to something super beautiful, is that now the ratio of the proper times is simply just GTT. Then I have d tau over d tau prime is, and so the only term which survives out of there is just gt theta. It's minus gtt evaluated at the point x divided, well, square root of that, divided by minus gtt evaluated at the point x prime. Right? Everything else dies off for static observers. Okay, but you know that you can interpret the fact, you know, how quickly your time goes, how quickly your clock ticks, to 1 over frequency of a wave which you can send. So let's say I tune my frequency of the thing with my clock. I send a signal with that frequency. And the frequency travels through the space-time, and it gradually changes, so that it agrees with the proper time of the other observer. Okay, so this is nothing else than nu prime over nu, or what we called before, omega prime over omega. Okay, and so this is the gravitational redshift for static observers. Gravitational redshift. Everybody happy with this? This is for static observers. Of course, this is more general than what we derived yesterday, but we better reduce to yesterday's result under certain circumstances. So, of course, what we considered before is was the homogeneous gravitational field, and let's say weak gravitational field, right? So let's see what happens in the homogeneous gravity. Okay, so in weak field, we have that omega prime divided by omega, and so now what is my minus GTT? So that's the part which we derive from the geodesic equation. So my minus GTT is simply 1 plus 2 phi newton over c squared. Okay. So this will be square root of 1 plus 2 phi newton divided by c squared, evaluated at the point x, and divided by 1 plus 2 phi newton at x prime over c square. Okay, so that's what we know. But of course, if you are in weak field, we better know that this is actually much smaller than 1. So we can do the Taylor expansion here. So this will be like 1 plus phi newton over c square at the point x times 1 minus phi newton at the point x prime over c square. And so if I keep only the terms which are linear in phi newton, so I'm throwing away phi newton at x minus phi newton at x prime. So this is equal to 1 plus phi newton at x minus phi newton at x prime divided by c square plus higher order terms. And so if you introduce this redshift, as we did before, which was omega prime minus omega divided by omega, all you do is that you just subtract minus 1 from here. And it's given by phi Newton at the point x minus phi Newton at the point x prime divided by c square. And that's the gravitational redshift in the weak field limit. So now let's use the homogeneous field. So now in homogeneous field, so specifically homogeneous field, well, we know that the Newtonian potential in homogeneous field is what? What is the potential energy in homogeneous gravitational field? Mgh. So very good. So now the potential will be just divided by m. So it's just gh, right? So in the specifically in the homogeneous field, you will have that this thing is just difference between the heights times g. So it's minus g delta h divided by c square, which is what we derived last time, just playing with the elevator. So you see that, you know, we went long way, right? So so we started with the elevator, and that actually forced us to think about these local inertial frames. But once we have local inertial frames, we can do coordinate transformations to some new frames. And you know, after that, we change the flat Minkowski metric to the curved one. And we change the geodesic equation in the special relativity to the new one, which has Christoffel symbols. Okay. But now we can use this curved metric to describe actually physics. And so for example, the gravitational redshift for two static observers will be simply given by this beautiful formula. And all you need to know to calculate this formula is just what we derived from the geodesic equation, the correspondence with the Newtonian theory in the weak field limit. And this is your general formula for a weak field thing. And if you specify the homogeneous gravitational field, of course, we better rederive the result which we have derived for the elevator there. All right. Are there any questions? So just a bit of warning. So if you understood everything until now, it's perfect. So let me just confuse you at the end. So what we are doing here is one big cheat. Okay? I am cheating here. So what I am trying to tell you here is that actually we can describe true gravitational fields by, you know, this curved metric and this Christoffel symbols and whatever. But all I have been doing is basically starting in this inertial frame in the Minkowski space, and then doing a coordinate transformation, okay, to some other frame. So not every gravitational field can be written in that way. It's not always possible, if you start with a curved metric, to find new coordinate system in which the metric would look flat. Okay, it's not always possible. So actually, the curved metric, or that's why I'm trying to write everything in terms of the curved metric, which is the fundamental object for the gravitational field. It's not always possible to find a coordinate transformation which would bring this metric to the flat form. So then you can sort of distinguish two gravitational fields for which this is not possible from the fake gravitational fields, which are simply a consequence of the change of the coordinates. Okay? And so we will discuss this tomorrow. So I'll give you an example of a fake gravitational field, which is super useful, especially for your homework. And then I will tell you what's different in the true gravitational field. Then I will tell you how Einstein derived these equations. We will have tomorrow the Einstein equations. But in order to understand what they really mean, we will have to do some geometry. So we will start some geometry tomorrow. So let me finish here.